I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Barclays paid a $450 million settlement, and the bank's chief executive, Robert Diamond, has resigned over a scandal involving the manipulation of interest rates. Other big banks are being investigated for similar behavior. This is just 2 months after J.P. Morgan Chase announced billions in losses from a failed hedging strategy. Its CEO, Jamie Dimon, called his bank's behavior stupid. These revelations raise questions about the effectiveness of banking regulations and how much Dodd-Frank has brought real reform to the country's financial system. We asked Jesse Eisinger to join us. He's a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He also writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. He won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that led to the financial crisis. And Jesse Eisinger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back, Marty.
You're welcome. Let's start with Barclays and explain to our listeners what a LIBOR rate is and why that's significant.
Sure. Well, LIBOR is a benchmark. It's set by banks, over a dozen banks back in 2007. And then the banks use it to set other interest rates that they charge customers. So it's kind of like the equivalent of the prime rate in the United States. It's the rate at which everything else is calibrated.
Now, Barclays has made this settlement and essentially acknowledged the fact that these rates were rigged. How significant is that?
Well, it's quite significant. So this there are about $360 trillion with a T assets based off of this lending rate, LIBOR, which, as I say, is this benchmark rate that's set based on the overnight rate that banks lend to each other. And the banks set it, and then they set other rates on top of it. So even if they were skimming just 1/100th of a percentage point, 1 basis point off of these rates, we're talking about skimming sort of $36 billion. So it could be quite an enormous amount of money here.
I was reading about some of the emails that have come to light, and I guess there should be some kind of a wall between those who set this LIBOR rate and the traders, but it looks like that wall was broken down in certain instances.
Exactly. What happened was there was sort of a casual indifference to manipulating this rate between traders, interbank traders, trading, talking to other banks and saying, can you give me this rate? I need this kind of rate better. It's better for me today for these kind of trades. And so what they were doing, and Barclays is only the first bank here to be exposed. They cooperated, but we have many other banks to go. UBS, a Swiss bank, is in the crosshairs most immediately, supposedly, but and what they were doing was manipulating the rate. Price fixing is what we call this in other industries. And the overseers were kind of asleep at the switch.
And who are the looking at Barclays? Who oversees Barclays?
Well, the British regulators oversee Barclays. At that point, it was the Financial Services Authority, the FSA, and then the Central Bank of England, the Bank of England. In the United States, it would be both the Federal Reserve and possibly the Securities and Exchange Commission. And one of the problems is that it's an infernally arcane and complex market, very big, happening very quickly, and the regulators are probably not that sophisticated. That's certainly what we saw in the J.P. Morgan trading situation, which is different, mm-hmm. but has some parallels. Again, what we're seeing is regulators being overmatched by the speed and complexity of the financial markets.
And I do want to get to J.P. Morgan Chase, but just staying with Barclays for a moment or two, what effect then does this this LIBOR scandal, what effect does it have on individual consumers? Does it trickle down to someone who might be, borrowing money to buy a car, for instance?
It could well have that effect. As I say, what they're doing is they were skimming off In some cases, they were skimming off a very, very small amount. It was kind of like the movie Superman 2, where Richard Pryor steals a penny, half a cent from every account. Nobody would notice it, but the effect would be that a fairly large amount of capital would be misallocated to the financial sector, inflating profits of the banks and taking a little bit of money from all of us. That's one possibility, and that certainly happened at least in the early part of the manipulation. The second part would be that the banks were using it to actually say that they were willing to lend at lower rates, ironically. And what that meant was that they were implying that they were more confident about lending to each other, which would have the effect of staving off intervention or regulation in a crisis. You know, if the banks say, the regulators say, well, how confident are you? How do you feel about other banks? What should we be intervening here? And they would say, no, everything is fine. Look at how low LIBOR is. Look at how low we're willing to lend to each other. The rate is so low that we're willing to lend to each other that we feel very confident. Mm. In fact, the rate was much higher. And that would have the effect of really possibly making an eventual crisis bigger when the truth came out.
But
and the third thing...
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Sure,
go ahead.
I was going to make a third point, which is that there's a casual indifference, an extraordinary fecklessness and indifference to regulation and the law and in banking right now. And this is revealed here, where they would very casually disregard laws and manipulate and price fix. And I think that's the largest message here, is that bankers are, and banks as institutions, are completely unchastised despite the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
Is it too soon to know whether banks were colluding with each other? Is that what investigators, regulators are going to try to figure out?
No, I think that is absolutely the case. The emails from Barclays reveal that the banks were colluding with each other. And we know that Barclays cooperated and that other banks are being investigated. And Barclays itself, in its own defense, says we weren't the worst. And I actually find that plausible. I think they probably, very possible, possibly weren't the worst. So I think we're going to find more banks doing this in worse ways.
So here we go again?
Well, I mean, we haven't stopped, Marty. I mean, the crisis is ongoing. The financial crisis hasn't really ended. Started in 2007, built up to a crescendo in 2008, and then we haven't fixed any elements of the banking system in any significant ways. And so, we have an ongoing financial crisis in Europe, and that's slightly separate but related to the crisis in morality, the crisis in business standards, the casual attitude toward lawbreaking that we have in the banking system. They're related, but they're not exactly the same, one and the same.
Well, one of the things we learned from this, the financial crisis, is the importance of trust, of trusting the system, at whether you use it as a high-priced banker or whether you're a consumer on the more ground level.
Yes, and I think that what we have seen is that an enormous amount of trust has been eroded in the banking system, especially between banks. So banks don't want to lend to each other because they don't understand what's inside the banks, the asset values. They don't trust them. And then consumers don't trust them, and that means that they're less willing to buy stocks from brokers who work at banks. They're less willing to lend and to borrow, and that has an eroding effect on, it hurts our economy.
Dodd-Frank was supposed to at least begin to address or maybe even fix some of these problems. Has it made a difference in any way from your perspective?
I think that Dodd-Frank has not yet shown any effect, and I think the banks are largely to blame for that. I think they have had an assault on Dodd-Frank. I think that Dodd-Frank was poorly designed and it lacked ambition at the beginning. I think that The financial crisis gave us a great opportunity to do two things. One was to remake our banking system to make it more stable, and the other was to completely overhaul our financial regulatory system, which is incomprehensible with multiple agencies doing overlapping things. And Dodd-Frank did neither of those things. Instead, it kind of layered on more laws and complex laws to our existing framework. And that was a giant missed opportunity. And now the banks are assaulting Dodd-Frank, and they're sort of doing it in multiple ways. But one way is to deluge the regulators with comment letters, adding in complexities and exemptions. And that has both served as delays. So Dodd-Frank has been massively delayed in many parts. And then it's also added in exemptions that will allow the banks to essentially continue business as usual. And then they're attacking with lawsuits, and then friendly lawmakers, mostly Republicans, but some Democrats, like Chuck Schumer from New York, the senator, are trying to roll back aspects of Dodd-Frank. So Dodd-Frank was not even half a loaf. I'd say it was about a half of a slice of a piece of bread, and now they're trying to take away those to leave us just with the crumbs.
So killing it with complexity, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, killing it with complexity. Exactly. I mean, one of the principles of regulation is to tie the hands of regulators, put in stupid or simple rules that the regulators then enforce in a simple way. You have to have this amount of capital, 20% or 15% of capital, and then the bankers wouldn't really be able to get around it because it would be a very simple rule. But instead, what they did was they said, we're going to layer in complexity, so you're going to have to interpret what is this kind of derivative, what is this kind of mortgage, what is this kind of proprietary trading for your own account. And that relies on very smart regulators, and even when you have the smartest, most professional regulators, they're not going to be as interested and as sophisticated as the bankers themselves. And so we've just set up a law that's not going to succeed.
We have about 45 seconds before our first break here, but are we talking about a banking system that's so complex it needs complex regulation, or is it possible to have simple regulation of the current banking system?
I think you could put in simple rules, but I think that the real answer would be to try to tackle the complexities by doing things like breaking up the banks, making them smaller. That would likely be a better solution. I don't think it's politically tenable at this point, but I actually think that the momentum is gathering, that the consensus is building that Dodd-Frank was, a failure, and that it was the wrong thing to wrong approach, and that they're going to try to revisit it.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter for ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. He has a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. Won a Pulitzer Prize for some of his reporting on questionable Wall Street practices. Much more after this very short break. Lines open. Any questions or comments? That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Woodmere Art Museum in Chestnut Hill supports WHYY and tells the story of Philadelphia's art and artists with two exhibitions on view through July 15th. Honoring the transatlantic link between Philadelphia and European modernism, Woodmere presents Salvatore Pinto, a retrospective celebrating the Barnes legacy. Guests are also invited to discover the hauntingly strange works of Philadelphia's realist artists in Haunting Narratives, Detours from Philadelphia Realism. Details at 215-247-0476 or woodmereartmuseum.org.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on America Abroad.
I said, who are the smartest guys you have who want to work on developing something that will pump water from sunshine?
Global demand for water is increasing along with the world's population, and sanitation is an issue in many places, making water management a crucial issue. The Global Water Challenge, next on America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Rising R&B star Frank Ocean revealed that his first love was another man, and hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons tweeted about Ocean's courage and honesty. Meanwhile, CNN journalist Anderson Cooper confirmed long-standing rumors that he's gay. The cost of coming out in the public eye is the talk of the barbershop. Next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jesse Eisinger from ProPublica about what, if anything, has changed in the banking industry and regulatory reform since the financial crisis. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jesse, before the break, you said reform would be smaller banks, and I'm looking at an article from Business Week quoting here, five banks, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs, held more than $8.5 trillion in assets at the end of 2011, equal to 56% of the U.S. economy, this according to the Federal Reserve. So big banks are even bigger?
Yeah, one of the results of the financial crisis was a further banking consolidation when banks like investment bank Bear Stearns or commercial mortgage bank Washington Mutual failed, J.P. Morgan took them over. When Countrywide failed, Bank of America took them over. When Merrill failed, Bank of America took them over. And so what we had was a further consolidation and concentration in the banking system. Now, it's not inherently the case that big banks are going to be inherently unstable and lead to crises. I don't think that Canada, for instance, has just a small handful of banks and didn't have an acute financial crisis. But I think it probably makes them more likely. And so one possible solution would be to have some kind of size limit or break them up on business lines. We had a law, Glass-Steagall, a Depression-era law, that separated commercial banking from investment banking. And we've tried to backdoor that through Dodd-Frank, through something called the Volcker Rule, which prevents banks from making bets with on their own account, proprietary trading, using money that's ultimately backstopped by the federal government implicitly or explicitly. And that's a kind of effective way to restore Glass-Steagall, but that's not the same as restoring Glass-Steagall.
And I do want to pick up on that. You mentioned J.P. Morgan Chase, and that takes us back to that announcement in May that J.P. Morgan Chase had lost billions in a failed hedging strategy. What's the significance of that announcement?
Sure. Well, this is very different from Barclays because J.P. Morgan hasn't been accused of breaking any laws, but it's an enormously significant trading loss. The first big important lesson here is that J.P. Morgan was regarded as the best-managed bank, and Jamie Dimon, their CEO, was regarded as the most careful bank CEO, the one who had steered the bank through the financial crisis, and the one that had very good risk management organization and techniques. And the fact that they lost sight of this trade, that they lost control and lost upwards of $4 or $5 billion, maybe more, it could be as much as $9 billion on some trades, makes the case that these banks are too complex to manage and should be broken up, and certainly too complex to be regulated adequately. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that this kind of trading, they say, was a hedge, in other words, something to protect themselves from some other kind of loss. But in fact, it looks to me undeniably like a proprietary bet, that they were essentially speculating based on their expectations for corporate defaults, especially in Europe. And because of that, we don't really want banks to be speculating with their money, because that money, as I say, is ultimately backstopped by you and me, the taxpayer. The most obvious way is that when you put money in on deposit at a bank, it's federally guaranteed. There's FDIC insurance on that money. We have deposit insurance. And because of that, the bank can't lose money on that. So they go out, if they wanted to, they go out and bet that on black at the casino. If they make money, they get to keep the profits. If they lose, the taxpayer has to shoulder the losses. That's a terrible situation, and a situation that causes incentives for banks to take huge high risks. So we don't want to create that situation.
And isn't that what the Volcker Rule is supposed to control?
Yes, the Volcker Rule is supposed to ban this kind of trading, proprietary trading. And the problem is that proprietary trading is kind of hard to define from outside. From when the regulators look at a trade, or when you and I would look at a trade, it's a little bit difficult for us to tell whether that's a hedge or whether that's a bet, a proprietary bet. And the banks know, of course, but the banks say, look, we have to be able to do trades that kind of look like proprietary trading in order to make markets so that we can have enough inventory for buyers and sellers, or to keep markets liquid. And if we don't have that, markets will seize up and no one can buy and sell, and cats and dogs will be living together, and we'll have another crisis.
But
So they're holding a gun to our heads and adding in all these exemptions to the Volcker Rule, which, as I was saying earlier, is a one way to create so many exemptions that you can continue to do business as usual.
So if Jamie Dimon says that he did not know that this was going on within his own bank, and I guess one must believe him, at least at this point, does that raise questions that if the CEO doesn't know what's going on, how would regulators find out?
Yeah, well, I don't believe that. And in fact, I think that there's been reporting that suggested that he had a pretty good idea of the fact that there were these kind of trades going on. He might not have understood that they were going to take losses, but that's a slightly different thing than not knowing about the trades. But it's either that he knew and let the trades go on, which is bad, or he didn't know,
right,
and the bank took huge losses without him knowing, and that's also bad. So it's either ignorance or incompetence, and I'm not sure which you'd like to choose, but what it speaks to is that even if you think that Jamie Dimon is a competent CEO, no one can manage these giant, complex organizations. And therefore, that argues for a possibility that you should find another solution to making a better banking system, a safer banking system, like potentially breaking them up.
And that's Jesse Eisinger, a senior reporter at ProPublica. He covers Wall Street and finance. He also has a regular column that he writes for the New York Times Deal Book, and won a Pulitzer Prize for the kind of reporting we have been talking about, looking at questionable Wall Street practices that led to the financial crisis. We are talking about what, if anything, has changed in the banking industry and how are regulators keeping up with our complex banking system. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Jesse, who's in charge of regulating our banking system?
We have a multiplicity of bank regulators. The main bank regulators for the big bank is the Federal Reserve. And, of course, we know the Federal Reserve mainly through their role in setting interest rates and trying to guide the economy through helping revive the economy when we have recessions and slow down the economy when it's too hot. But the Federal Reserve actually has a vast, enormous, complex banking regulatory apparatus. It gets much less attention. And then there's the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is nestled in the Treasury Department, and that is an enormously powerful and also complex and very big banking regulator. And then we have the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and they monitor banks, mostly smaller banks, in order to protect the deposit insurance fund that they have accumulated through fees that they charge the banks. And so that's the three. And then, of course, you have the Securities and Exchange Commission and the I'm not finished yet.
Okay,
the
keep
Commodity
going.
Futures Trading Commission. That regulate trading, and that since banks do those kind of trading, the SEC and the CFTC also regulate them. So that's the top five right there.
Are there too many regulators?
I think it's self-evident. They're practically running out of letters for the acronyms. I forgot to mention a few others, like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was bestowed on us by the Dodd-Frank bill, and that's to regulate banks when they have interactions with individuals and retail customers. So it seems to me like you could make a very good case that we need to rationalize this structure to have one regulator for securities instead of two. You would have one banking regulator instead of a multiplicity of banking regulators. The problem is that bureaucracies in Washington have enormous amount of power self-preservation abilities, and then banks like certain regulators because they can play them off of others. So the OCC is an enormously friendly regulator to banks, and banks find that very useful and want to preserve that. That's called regulatory capture. They have captured the regulators. So, and the Fed is captured by regulators too, largely. So we have a very unwieldy, complex regulatory system that could really be revisited.
Let me quote something you wrote for ProPublica about the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, one of these regulators you just mentioned. And you write, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency is so lenient on banks it is supposed to regulate that it could be mistaken for a division of the United States Chamber of Commerce. Does its new head, Thomas J. Curry, have any hope of giving it a backbone? That's how you begin your piece. What's the answer to that question?
I'm too soon to tell? I'm very pessimistic. I always like to hear myself quoted.
I do. You're welcome.
I'm very pessimistic about the OCC. I think that Curry seems like a good appointee. He was just installed in the spring to the head of this organization that has historically been extremely bank-friendly. But the organization itself may reject the transplant. He comes from the FDIC, which has been a tougher regulator. The problem is that the OCC has a bunch of very sophisticated lifetime regulators who have kind of an ideological view that the government shouldn't really regulate banks. And if you're the regulator and you believe that the government shouldn't regulate banks, it's tough to do your job adequately. So we'll see if Curry can really remake this organization. But I suspect that it's not the case. And the problem often is that the regulators think that they're smart enough to be able to thread these needles, to say, well, we can figure out what is proprietary trading, what is market making. We can do this kind of very delicate, sophisticated dance. And no one wants to think that the bankers are going to be smarter than you are if you're a regulator. That's obviously inherently offensive. You think that you're just as smart as the bankers. And so so you think that you can be more sophisticated, and that's a very dangerous thing for a regulator to think.
Let me get Roger from Newark to join us. And, Roger, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
Mr. Eisinger, it's worse than just if Jamie Dimon didn't know what was going on with J.P. Morgan Chase, which would just be ignorance. If you look back to 2008, Goldman Sachs knew that the collateralized debt obligations, to use the fancy term for the bundles of mortgages that it was peddling around Wall Street, were likely to fail. It had bets where it would profit and, in fact, did profit when they did fail. So it was not a matter of simple ignorance, which may or may not be all it was with J.P. Morgan Chase, but the regulation was so perverse that they permitted it would be like a manager, Charlie Manuel of the Phillies, getting more money the worse their record is.
Well, Roger, let me take your point, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Jesse Eisinger a chance to weigh in. What do you think?
Well, I agree with the caller that the Goldman Sachs case and other banks involved in the CDO business, these bundles of mortgages, were building things that in order to fail and betting against them, taking advantage of their customers. Goldman was a prime example of it, but that's what we, Jake Bernstein and I, won the Pulitzer for, was a series of stories about that very thing with other banks, primarily Merrill Lynch, helping hedge fund clients, primarily a fund called Magnetar. So that is definitely true, and what I think is woeful is the lack of any criminal prosecutions or any high-up individuals having been charged for those activities with regard to mortgage-backed securities and mortgage-backed securities that were derivatives, like CDOs. So the proprietary trading at J.P. Morgan is very different, though. They weren't. I don't think that they were breaking any laws. Is so far that I can see. They may. Jamie Dimon may have, and top officials of J.P. Morgan may have been misleading to investors about the losses before they reported their recent quarter. That would be a potential breaking of the law, and that should be investigated. But they weren't. It's not quite analogous to what Goldman Sachs was doing.
Let me get Chris from Reading to join us before we have to say goodbye to you, Jesse. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I was just commenting that it's kind of like the emperor isn't wearing any clothes, and nobody's willing to say it. Basically, Wall Street is a bunch of people with running on fraud. You've got people with debt swaps that have that are basically taking out insurance without having any insurable interest. Now, if you or I were to do that, then we'd be thrown in jail for fraud. They're getting away with it. I'd like to know what your guess there has to say about that. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Chris, for calling into Radio Times. Are we talking about fraud here, Jesse?
Well, I think we're talking about multiple frauds in multiple areas. CDOs was a fraud. The LIBOR manipulation were frauds. There were a lot of misleading disclosures about their asset values in the lead-up to the financial crisis. So I do think so. You know, I think the caller was talking about credit default swaps and whether those are sort of inherently fraudulent because you don't have an insurable interest. And that's a debatable point, but for them, you could call that an intellectual fraud. It's not a legal fraud because it's perfectly legal. And one of the big problems that we have with the financial system that persists even post-crisis and post-Dodd-Frank is that a lot of the bad activity is legal. So we should have fixed it with better laws and better regulations. So I think that we should have prosecuted more, and then we should also have fixed the banking system in a way that might have prevented or at least made much more rare financial crises. But unfortunately, we didn't do that.
I'm looking at the clock here about a minute. Is it possible to revisit reform then, or is it sort of stacked against that?
Well, that's... That is the important question here. And the question is whether there's some momentum that builds with these smaller things that aren't crises, like J.P. Morgan's loss and the banking and the Barclays LIBOR scandal. And if that builds momentum to say, we really need to revisit this, or the more likely and more dire scenario is that we have to have a much bigger crisis the next time. And I thought, you know, after the NASDAQ bubble burst, after the stock market bubble burst, I thought, boy, we're going to have major reforms. We have to, because in the wake of that, we had Enron and WorldCom and those accounting scandals. And then that, I was totally wrong. We had a bigger bubble that time. Then we had the housing bubble. And then we had a crisis in 2008. And I thought again, okay, this is it. This is the time when we reform the banking system. We have to, because it really almost cratered the global economy for good, instead of just giving us the worst recession since the Great Depression.
And I hate
so
to...
do we need a bigger crisis? I don't know. I hope not.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but always enjoy having you on Radio Times. Jesse Eisinger, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Over 100 years ago, the Yale archaeologist Hiram Bingham explored the Andes and found the lost city of Machu Picchu. Recently, Mark Adams retraced Bingham's journey, but Adams wasn't an adventurer. He was a writer.
I was a tenderfoot. I was gasping for air. I was on all fours at some point. It was tough.
Mark Adams on the next Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, James Murphy, founder of the dance indie rock band LCD Sound System. The new film, Shut Up and Play the Hits, documents LCD Sound System's farewell concert last year at Madison Square Garden. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Why are so many black bears showing up within city limits? Wildlife officials say get used to it. Also, the old 97's Rhett Miller goes solo again, his killer combo of country rock and power pop on his new CD. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about some recent banking scandals. We're taking a look at Dodd-Frank and its centerpiece, the Volcker Rule. And joining us now is Caitlin Klein. She's a former derivatives trader, a current activist with the Occupy movement, working on financial regulation and reform. She was also co-author of the Occupy SEC's working group, 325-page comment letter. They urge financial regulators to write and implement a strong and meaningful Volcker Rule. And Caitlin Klein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And before I get to the work that you're doing now, I'm interested in the 6 years that you spent as a credit derivatives trader. What was your job?
I was a trader, so I was a market maker at an investment bank. So it's sort of when you think of the trading floor and people buying and selling and screaming, that's sort of what it was like, except instead of stocks, it was these sort of esoteric derivative products.
And you left in 2010. Why did you leave?
You know, it's a little bit of a complicated question. I think that, you know, one thing that really attracted me to the job in the first place was this idea that it should have been a very obvious meritocracy, right? I mean, you have a profit and loss, and if you, you know, make a certain amount of money, it sort of, you know, tells you how good you are at your job. And what I found throughout my working was that you know, that's very much not the case, and that there's a lot of incompetence and there's a lot of nepotism. And realistically, you know, there's so many backdoor sort of handshake deals that go on all day, and that really wears on you. And particularly when you're trading sort of through 2007, 2008, this crisis happening, you know, it was really a kind of a high-stakes situation, and looking around and not really having a lot of faith in the system that you were a part of, you know, really, you know, wore me down. So after things sort of calmed down and the follow-up from Lehman seemed to have settled, I decided that I needed to get out and try something new.
Well, one of the things that you tried, you became involved with the Occupy Wall Street movement. What was the attraction to that?
I think that, you know, it had been about a year since I had left, and it was very much when I found out that people were sort of down there, you know, making these calls about exactly the same things that I witnessed on the street. You know, we had people doing teach-ins on what is a derivative and, you know, general sort of financial knowledge for the public that a lot of people really don't know about. And I was really had a lot of personal experience with that stuff. I really sat in the middle of it and was able to witness a lot of it and thought that this is a place where I can use what I gained in my career. I can use this to really educate people and try and get people on board with the changes that need to be made, because it's a very, very difficult position that we are in right now with the financial system and our economy, and a lot needs to be done. And unless there is public support out there, it doesn't feel like any of it's really going to move in the right direction. So,
well, let me ask you about the Volcker Rule. You were part of this Occupy SEC working group and wrote a 325-page comment letter about the Volcker Rule. And I do want to get into some of the details. My understanding, the sort of shorthand version of what the Volcker Rule says, is that commercial banks can't make risky bets with federally insured deposits. Is that enough of a description, or do we need to add to that?
Well, I think it's even a little bit more simple than that. Mm-hmm. It's this idea that if you're a bank and you take people's money in deposits and you're supposed to be giving it out in lending, you can't also be betting that money in the form of proprietary trading and speculative trading and betting. So trying to separate those two activities is more or less what the goal of the Volcker Rule is.
And as you look at the Volcker Rule as it stands today, does it address the problems that you observed?
I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, the Volcker Rule isn't in its final form yet, so we don't really know how it's going to look when it's finished. But the draft rule seemed, it certainly had the right goal, and it seemed like if regulators got in there and made sure that they could kind of tighten up a lot of the language, then it could be very effective, and it really could do a lot to ensure that people are making honest trades, and, you know, the really kinds of big risky bets would be prohibited and would be very obvious and overseen. It's a little bit frustrating when you look at the effect that the banks have, because they can go in and really it's pretty easy for them to explain away some of these big risky bets that they want to make as important financial activities. And they've made that case very, very well to the regulators. So it's not clear how strong this rule will be once it goes through. We're sort of hoping that in the light of all of these recent scandals, that there'll be more and more pressure for the regulators to act decisively.
Now, you're one of the writers of this 325-page. Would it be fair to say a critique of the Volcker Rule?
Yeah, we really went through page by page.
I know you did.
It was it was a lot of work, but it's a very dense rule, and there's a lot going on in there, and there's a lot of sort of very sneaky one line, what seemed to us as loopholes, right, and little language changes that would allow activity that might kind of go under the radar if nobody points it out. So we spent a lot of time looking at the real nitty gritty of this law and sort of how you can get around some of the things that they're trying to control with the law.
Are we seeing the work then of lobbyists to try to, if not complicate the rule, give banks advantage through this rule?
Oh, very much. I mean, we saw almost direct language from the initial letters from lobbying groups that were translated word for word into the draft rule of the law. You know, they had a very significant effect on the writing and the language of the rule. Sometimes they, clearly submitted whole paragraphs that got put into the language of the rule. So, I mean, the lobbyists are some of the most important people when it comes to drafting a lot of this financial regulation, but particularly we saw with the Volcker Rule.
And would you say that the goal of either your critique, also the Volcker Rule, is to protect consumers from financial misbehavior?
I think that is the case. I think it's a little bit more, in the case of the Volcker Rule, I think it's a little bit more removed from their effect on consumers directly as it is their effect on the financial system, which affects consumers. I think what would be sort of the best end goal for consumers would be, and Jesse sort of touched on it, is this return to Glass-Steagall, which was a law that we had for a long time, right? It was a post-Depression era law that separated those banking functions from those investment banking functions. And that really is something that protects consumers, because your money is in a deposit institution that is very separate from market investing. The Volcker Rule is a little bit short of that. It's basically the best we could do in this environment, and it should do a lot to encourage the stability of banks, but won't necessarily directly protect your money. But you can be a little bit, you can feel a little bit safer that your money in a bank, is being protected if they can't do kind of the egregious betting that we've seen J.P. Morgan and other banks do at the time.
And that's Caitlin Klein, our second of two guests in this hour of Radio Time. She's a former derivatives trader, and she's an activist with the Occupy movement. She was also co-author of the Occupy SEC Working Group's comment letter urging financial regulators to write and implement a strong and meaningful Volcker Rule. We are talking about some of the complexities of our financial system, but that's the system that we have. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I asked Jesse Eisinger this a similar question, whether it's bringing back Glass-Steagall or some kind of reform that separates these two wings of the banking industry. Do you see an appetite for that at all, Caitlin?
Not so much, or certainly not maybe 6 months ago when we were really working on this. It was something that would borderline get laughed at in serious policy discussions. I think that is changing. I think people are paying a lot more attention to it now when this idea that we need to do something broader is gaining traction. And I think people are becoming a little bit more sensitive to the wider outrage as we just have sort of scandal after scandal. And it's pretty clear that something needs to be done. And I don't know that Glass-Steagall is the answer to those, but I know that it is an answer to some of these problems, and people are receptive to that. So I think if we kind of get out there and beat the drum now, it's getting more and more attention.
And who was your letter addressed to, this 325-page critique? Who was it to?
So that alphabet soup of regulators that Jesse went through, there's actually five key regulators that will coordinate to implement the Volcker Rule. So it's the Fed, the CFTC, the OCC, the SEC, and Treasury.
And did you get a response from any of those?
Oh, we did, and we went down to have meetings with all of them, and, you know, they're very responsive, and they took a lot of time to read and go through and ask us a lot of questions. It's hard to say where that will lead, but, you know, they certainly read our letter and took it very seriously.
And would it be fair to say that the other members of Occupy SEC are like yourselves in that they have worked in this industry?
I mean, we had a couple other ex-industry people. We had some current industry people. We had some lawyers and, you know, just some other individuals that were careful readers and fast learners who sat and were just a tremendous help to us.
And where's the Occupy movement today? How would you describe it?
I think it's in transition. I think that right now a lot of people are really getting very focused on their particular group. There's a lot of really exciting actions happening on sort of a smaller scale. As people sort of group up outside of Zuccotti Park, you know, and find people with common interest, there's a lot of really interesting things happening within, you know, banking reform, but also in the foreclosure movement, and, you know, there's just so much happening. I think it's a really exciting time.
I was reading about, I don't know if it's an actual Occupy Bank, but are there ways to rethink banking, whether it's through things like credit unions or co-ops or community banks, these are things that already exist, but as a model going forward?
Sure. There's a really fascinating group that is doing this Occupy Bank, which is trying to do exactly that, is rethink what would a banking system that worked for consumers and individuals, what would that look like, and why don't we start it, right, if it's not out there? And they've been for months talking to different people and getting lots of ideas and drafting a business plan, and they're, you know, really moving along in that process. I think there's also the Move Your Money campaign, which is really important, and trying to get people to take your money out of big banking institutions into local nonprofit credit unions and other sort of alternative banking institutions, which is gaining a lot of traction and is really good probably for everybody.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Tim from Hillsboro joining us on Radio Times. And Tim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, two comments I'd like to make.
Sure.
One of them is, why does the federal government subsidize the banking industry to the tune of billions of dollars? I mean, Bank of America got billions of dollars from the government to subsidize their banking industry. And why does the federal government give all the banks 0% interest on money, and then the banks turn around and get a consumer for 10 to 15% on a credit card? It's ridiculous. It's the craziest system. Whoever thought this system up must have been out of their mind, because the cards are stacked against the taxpayer versus the banks. They all make millions and millions of dollars. Look at the amount of money that the CEO of Bank of America made last year. It's ridiculous.
Well,
nobody should be able to make that kind of money, and he doesn't generate any kind of
job. All right, fair enough. We hear you. Let me give Caitlin Klein a chance to respond. Caitlin, can you connect with what Tim is saying there?
Yeah, I think that it's one of the strongest arguments that the banks and the banking lobby has, and that one that's really answered by the regulators, is this idea that this system is so important that, you know, the federal government needs to do everything in its power to make sure that nothing happens to our current system, that it would just be absolute, you know, catastrophic consequences if they didn't do everything in their power, and that includes 0% loans, and that includes subsidies, and all of this stuff that we see as, you know, just really unfair. But in their opinion, if they didn't do these things, you know, everybody would lose their job, and it would be widows and orphans would, you know, it would be just be a horrible scenario. And I think anyone who sort of looks at the situation, you know, thinks that that's pretty silly, but it's kind of the way things are operating in the federal government. And it's really important that we get out there and tell them that there is another way for a banking system to work, and that we need to move towards that instead of saving this sinking ship that is our current system.
Do you fear, though, for the U.S., if not economy, financial system?
I do. I'd like to say I was a little bit more optimistic about it. I think we're in for some really choppy waters, and the most disappointing or the most frightening part is that it's not clear that we have a very good plan at this point moving forward. I think there's a lot of things that need to happen, and probably the most important one is getting a serious discussion from sort of politicians and regulators about making real changes, how those should be made, and moving forward with them. And we're not even sort of at the first base of that.
And what would be top on your list for that particular change? What would, from your perspective, what would improve the system, reform the system?
I think sort of the two main goals should be downsizing the banks and separating them on business lines, mm-hmm. right? So making sure that we get rid of this sort of failed experiment in conglomerate banking. I think it has been a disaster since we started letting these gigantic mergers occur. And if we can sort of break up the banks in terms of size and then do it smarter on business lines and make sure that the appropriate business activities are sort of siloed in their own sort of Glass-Steagall style, you know, their place, I think that will do a lot to make sure that we're not having these kind of gross interferences that we're seeing now.
And we're almost almost at the end of the hour, actually, but do you see support for that idea from Congress, from the White House?
I think it's growing, and I think the more we see these sort of headlines with, you know, $1 trillion and things like that in it, I think people will realize that it's sort of the necessary course of action. I don't know that it's happening yet, mm-hmm. but I think, you know, if we can keep the pressure on and kind of keep yelling in the streets about how they need to pay attention to these things and come up with meaningful reforms, I hope that's in the cards.
Well, Caitlin Klein, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. She's a former credit derivatives trader who helped to draft a letter on the Volcker Rule as a member of Occupy the SEC. Also with us earlier in the hour, Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter for ProPublica, and we were talking about our banking system. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.